Welcome to the Royal College of GPs Essential Knowledge Update podcast. My name is Sally Higginbottom and today I'm going to be interviewing Dr. May Tran about the new sign guidance on epilepsy in adults. Hello, May.
Oh, hi, Sally.
If a patient comes to see you with possible seizures, what do you want to know about in the history?
I think the first thing really is to try to take a very clear history from a patient, and ideally eyewitness account, maybe from a friend or family member who has witnessed a seizure during and before and after the suspected seizure. Certain aspects in the history you might want to ask about. So if there's been any spontaneous or unexplained symptoms, so we're looking at any sudden falls or in particular involuntary jerking movements of the limbs, any funny spells the patient has had, and if there was any incontinence of urine at the time. Also some odd behaviours such as lip smacking, chewing, swallowing, and any confused type behaviour in the history.
Yeah, now what's on your differential other than epilepsy style seizure disorder?
It seems to be quite a long differential. So certain situations that can present very similar to epilepsy are things like vasovagal syncopes, but usually you don't really get the post-istal confusion that you get in an epileptic. Also, we might think about things like cardiac syncope, but usually in this kind of situation, there might be a history of sudden death or congenital heart disease in the family to raise this suspicion. There are also non-epileptic kind of attack disorders, and these are more psychological based. And usually, when the patient is had investigations further down the line, things like the EEG and MRI might be normal in these type of patients. There are other conditions as well that might be very similar to a seizure, so even things like migraines or hyperglycemia or patients who've had head injuries can have seizure type symptoms as well.
Okay, so quite a wide variety of things to look for. And if you were examining a patient, is there anything specific you should include?
Looking at the basics, so you do the general observations, so examination might include blood pressure, so you might want to include a lying and standing blood pressure, and also very simply just assessing the patient's pulse, just to check there's any slight irregularity in their rhythm of the pulse that might point towards a differential diagnosis of a cardiac type event. Further down the line, you might want to do blood tests, including things like a full blood count, check for any anemia, check their blood sugars and also their renal function for any abnormalities and electrolytes. You might also want to do a 12-lead ECG in general practice.
Sure, okay. And I see we should be able to get these people seen fairly rapidly, and the guidance is that people should be seen in a first fit clinic within 2 weeks. What's your experience of that as a GP?
I think that's quite unrealistic working in the NHS. I think sometimes when I refer patients to see a neurologist, even an urgent referral can take several weeks if I'm lucky. Sometimes I've found when I'm very worried that this patient might have a fit quite soon after seeing them, I might want to refer to the neurological registrar on call or the consultant on call directly in the hospital. So they would give me a bit more advice. And sometimes, quite often, they might also fast track the patient into their clinics by this route as well, if you have a strong concern about a patient having a further fit quite soon.
Yes, I think it varies a lot by area. I mean, where I am, we do have first fit clinics and people are seen pretty rapidly and are often referred straight there from A&E, but I know that's not the situation everywhere. Once they get to the specialist, the diagnosis of epilepsy is very much a secondary care diagnosis, isn't it? But what are they looking for to make a diagnosis of epilepsy?
Well, it seems from the sign guidance that it's more based on how many fits they've had, at least 2 unprovoked fits, more than 24 hours apart is the initial diagnosis. But there are also things like if they've had 1 unprovoked seizure and further seizures as recurrence, or if they have some kind of epilepsy syndrome. Interestingly, usually, according to the sign guidance and the evidence, EEGs and MRIs are not always used in diagnosis of epilepsy, but usually as a GP, diagnosis is not down to us, it's usually down to the neurologist at the hospital.
Absolutely, and similarly, decisions about starting anti-epileptics is usually a secondary care decision. But what do you think our role is with the anti-epileptic medication?
And usually my role as a GP is to check that they are compliant with their medication, make sure their annual medication reviews are up to date, also check whether childbearing women are on the right contraception.
Absolutely. And what would a good contraceptive in general terms for someone with epilepsy be?
The guidance does recommend that the women are on something like the Mirena coil, the IUS. Yeah. They don't really recommend the progesterone-only pill or the implant at all. And usually if a patient is on liver enzyme-inducing anti-epileptic medication, so that is, for example, carbamazepine, oxycarbazepine and phenytoin, if they were going to have a combined oral contraceptive pill, the guidelines recommend that they have at least 50 micrograms daily of estrogen with that.
Okay, so it's what we might think of as a stronger pill to use. And similarly, we might be the only clinician seeing a woman whose epilepsy is very stable and then she's thinking of getting pregnant. What advice should we be giving prenatally?
Well, actually, the guidance, interestingly, recommends that all primary care physicians should start preconception counselling as soon as the woman becomes sexually active, which obviously is not very realistic. If a woman is trying for a child or has found out she's recently become pregnant, the guidelines recommend that if she does have a family history of neurotube defects or is on an anti-epileptic medication or her body mass index is over 30, we should be offering at least 5 milligrams a day of folic acid and also referring her joint care with the epilepsy specialist and the antenatal clinic.
So are there any medications we should be particularly concerned about in women of childbearing age?
There is a higher risk of teratogenicity with medications like sodium valproate. So usually at this instance, I would probably contact the obs and gynae registrar on call for advice ASAP or refer more urgently to the antenatal clinic.
Absolutely, and it may be worth thinking about changing a woman of childbearing age into a different anti-epileptic before that situation arises, I guess.
Yes, just to preempt it.
Okay, so obviously women of childbearing age are one special group. Is there anything different in elderly patients or those with a learning disability we should bear in mind?
In elderly patients, it seems from the guidance that it is the most commonest time in the West for them to develop epilepsy. And the most commonly used medication in elderly patients is lamotrigine or gabapentin as an alternative. And usually the mortality seems to be higher in elderly patients, 2 to 3-fold, and they have a higher risk of cerebrovascular disease and stroke in these patients. There is a special section on people with learning disabilities. They are usually given the same types of anti-epileptics as someone who doesn't have a learning disability, although as a GP would make sure that they have enough time in the consultation to get more informative history from the patient and usually from their carers as well.
Yeah, I see. It looks from the guidance as if the plan for controlling a seizure that lasts for more than a few minutes in the community has changed a bit, so we've moved away from PR diazepam now. Is that right?
Yes, so it seems from the guidance that the first choice is midazolam 10 milligrams buccally or intranasally. However, in my experience working in different general practices around London and Hertfordshire, that doesn't seem to be freely available in the grab bag. So more freely available is diazepam 10 milligrams, usually rectally, but that seems to be the third choice in the signed guidance.
Yes, and I can see that it may be much more acceptable for patients and carers to look at buccal or intranasal midazolam, and that might be a sort of learning point from this module that we could take back to our practices.
Yes, that's right. Like you said, the route is a lot easier with midazolam than rectal diazepam.
Yeah, okay. And the perennial question always comes with driving and fits. Is it still 1 year seizure-free to get your licence back?
Yes, that's for the type 1 car drivers. So usually your regular car driver or someone who drives a motorcyclist, But usually if you drive, for example, a large goods vehicle or passenger type vehicle, like a minibus, you have to be 10 years fit free.
10 years, wow. So that's obviously a much longer course. Okay. Thinking about the medication, just before we finish, there seem to be concerns about bone health for people on antiepileptics, and that wasn't something I really thought much about before. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yes, this was also something I learnt whilst doing the e-module. So it appears that for certain antiepileptics, so the main ones are carbamazepine and sodium valproate, which I see a lot of patients on, this does seem to be a high risk of fractures. Usually odds of fracture 1.2 to 2.4 times more than the average person. And this increases more significantly if the patient is a postmenopausal woman. The guidelines recommend that if there is a risk of a fracture, we would need, as a GP, as part of our management in the medication review, we would need to discuss dietary and other lifestyle factors to minimise this risk of osteoporosis.
Okay, and that was one of my top tips for this module. Were there any other top tips you want to leave us with as we finish?
One of the top tips I found out after summarising this guidance for the essential knowledge updates was that they mentioned that routine anti-epileptic blood levels is not needed for all of the patients. Things like full blood count and liver function test monitoring is absolutely unnecessary. And if we were going to do them, then leave them to the specialist.
Yes, so I see in the guidelines we don't need to do routine monitoring of blood levels or LFTs or full blood counts on these patients. But there might be situations where the specialist wants us to do some monitoring, for example, if someone is having their phenytoin dose adjusted, or if we're thinking about questions around adherence or toxicity, or in unusual situations where drug metabolism might be changing, like in pregnancy, or if seizure control has suddenly deteriorated. So there will be times to do these tests, but we don't need to do them, say, as part of our annual review.
Yes.
Thank you, May, for taking us through the epilepsy module, and thank you for listening to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of GPs.